Good morning and welcome to hour number two of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for our show, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Jason Croft is at the controls this morning. As the United States prepared for war with Iraq, the Bush administration listed 45 countries supporting that invasion. Now, today, you can go to the White House official website and you can look at a press release, one that was just dated days after the invasion, and that says the number is 49. Well, this morning in this part of Focus 580, we have with us two guests, both of them from the University of Illinois, who argue that this difference in the number is not just a simple error. Our guests, Scott Althaus and Kalev Lutaro, say that the White House has been engaged in rewriting history by deleting some documents and changing others without indicating that those changes had been made. Has some rather significant implications for anyone who is interested in history or for scholars who are trying to document what has happened in the past. They've spent quite a lot of time looking at this. It is, on the one hand, a complicated story, and we'll try to give it to you in some detail. And on the other hand, it's actually, when you think about its implications, why it's important, it's actually rather simple. We have them both here in the studio with us, and we're pleased that they could spend some time talking. Scott Althaus is Associate Professor in the Departments of Political Science and Communication here at the University of Illinois. And Kalev Lutaro is Coordinator of Information Technology and Research at the Klein Center for Democracy, which is based here at the U of I. He's Chief Technology Advisor to the Institute for Computing in the Humanities, Arts, and Social Sciences, and he's a center affiliate of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications here at the U of I. Questions are certainly welcome as we talk. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Those are the numbers. At any point here, questions are welcome. Well, thank you both very much for being here. This is, as I've sat and have tried to read through your account of what you found and how you find it, I very quickly got very confused. So maybe the easiest way, I think, is for me, well, first of all, to ask this question. Let us say that right before the United States went into Iraq, if you went to the White House website and your question was, how many countries have signed up for this? How many countries have said, we are going to support the United States in this? What would that number have been?
As of 5 p.m. on March 20th, 2003, the official White House press release stated that there were at least 44 countries in the coalition. By sometime between then and midnight, it was up to 45, and 45 was the number that started out the invasion period.
All right. Now, and then today, as I understand it, and correct me if I get this wrong, today, if you go to the White House website, you can find a press release that is dated a week later, right? So,
yes.
So we're in a matter of days later, mm-hmm. March 27th, 2003. Now, and on that, it says the number is 49.
One version of that document says there are 49. There was an earlier version for a while that said 48.
So the question then is, in that period, in that 1 week period, from right before to a week later, did in fact the United States pick up another four countries supporting the war in Iraq?
That seems to be the case. So over the course of the first several days of the invasion, more and more countries were being added to the list of coalition countries supporting the invasion. And the White House released new press releases for a period of time over that first week. We can identify four of them that were released during that week. There may be a fifth that was the one that mentioned at least 44, and we don't count that in our analysis. So there were a sequence of releases that went out over the week. But we also found evidence that within a week of the first release going out, that first release had already been changed. And the country of Panama had been added to that list, and the date had remained the same.
Okay. And now, so the document that's on there now, this one that we're talking about that's dated March 27th, 2003, you found out, and we can talk about how it is you found out, that sometime after March 27th of 2003, it was changed, but the date that's on there was not. So if you looked at it, you'd think, well, that was the release as it was issued March 27th of 2003, but that's not correct.
And that's where the story gets complicated, because for some of the documents, the dates remain the same. For the one in particular that you're mentioning, at some point later, the date was updated to February of 2004, but as far as we can tell, the content had not been changed. But it was within the next 6 or 7 months that document was removed from the White House website, and it was no longer accessible for a period of weeks. When that document was brought back up after the November election in 2004, it had been backdated to March 27th, and it contained a different list of countries than the original had.
Okay. And even today, are you, if you go to the White House website, will you find press releases that have all different numbers for this particular number of how many countries
are involved? It's also important to note for the March 27th that there's actually two lists on the White House website today that say March – that are dated March 27th, 2003. Both say that there are 49 nations. One of them only has 48 in the list below it, though. Costa Rica is the country that's removed. Mm-hmm. And as Scott was saying, when that was put back up, it said that the list was postdated to March 27th, 2003. It said that there were 48 nations and had Costa Rica removed, and then was subsequently updated again to change the number. There's text that says there are X number of nations and then a list below it, and that was changed then to say, okay, actually there's 49 and there were still 48 in that list. So today, depending on which of these two URLs you go to, you're going to get one list that has Costa Rica and one does not.
And then also, were there some – so we're talking about altering, changing dates, changing numbers on documents that are on there now. Were there also some documents that at one point were actually on the website that now are not there anymore?
Yes, there were. We've been able to find through various archives outside of the White House webpage copies of – memos of press releases that went out, a total of 5 documents. Two of those are no longer available today. One of them, if you go to the White House webpage, returns a page not found error. The other returns a page that has the template of a White House press release, but in which the content has been stripped away. So it's an empty page has been left up. And those two lists that were deleted were the two earliest lists that we were able to find from the start of the invasion period. And they had contained, even though both of them had been updated, the number of countries had been updated without redating the document, those had shown fewer than 48 or 49 countries. So today, on the White House webpage, you can't find a press release that indicates fewer than 49 countries as of March 27th.
Mm-hmm. And this, one of the things about this that's interesting is that you got into this really, it was an accident.
Yes.
Tell that story about how it is you even started looking at this at all.
Sure. Well, I am a co-author on a paper that's coming out in the American Behavioral Scientist this coming January, co-author with Andrew Cortell and Robert Isinger of Lewis and Clark College. And we wanted to go back and try to understand how the United States government had adopted the embedded journalism system that was brought into the Iraq invasion for the first time on a large scale. And a lot of people thought that this would be for purposes of deceiving international audiences or the American public, and that's the rumor that goes around. But we were curious to find out why. Well, in the course of doing this research, I had to look up the number and names of coalition countries to find out if coalition countries had been privileged in the number of embedded journalism slots that they were given. I found out they weren't. But when the copy editor brought this copy back to us 2 years after it had been written, there was a note that said that this one URL to the coalition list that I had cited 2 years earlier was now returning a blank page, and you needed to fix that. So I went back and thought I must have gotten the URL wrong, and went and looked, and sure enough, it was a blank page. So I did a little bit more searching and found that the remaining documents I could find on the White House webpage were not giving the same information that I had written down 2 years ago from the official, what I thought was the official list back then. I was able to find a copy on Wikipedia that purported to be the original, and the next day I said to Kalev, hey, look what I found. This document seems to have been stripped out of the White House webpage, but I think I found the original on Wikipedia, and isn't that interesting? And that's where Kalev took it and investigated further.
Yeah, well, we pick up the story then.
Yeah, I mean, so when Scott came to me and I saw this version on Wikipedia and he said, you know, this doesn't quite jive with what I remember, you know, my first inclination was, well, there must be a problem with this file that was uploaded to Wikipedia. You know, where did this come from? You know, and start looking at that. But, you know, everything seemed legitimate there. I mean, it looked like it was a real screen capture of a White House webpage. And so on a complete whim, I went to a website called the Internet Archive. I can talk more about this later, but it's a wonderful website that basically archives a good portion of the Internet over time. So you can go and type in a URL and see what it looked like in different times. And so I went and just, on a complete whim, typed this URL in there and came back with several different versions, clicked on the earliest version, and wow, this looks very odd. And then clicked through a few more of the versions and said, wow, you know, this page has actually changed over time. That release date up there, you know, there's several versions with the same release date that have different versions of this list. And, you know, and then, you know, went and talked to Scott and then, you know, at first we thought maybe this is just one list. But then, you know, as we began digging further, we began seeing, no, wow, this same list across its different incarnations on the White House webpage, each of them had undergone this different series of revisions.
Mm-hmm. And this is really interesting because if not for the opportunity to go back and see to this particular site where what they're doing periodically is they're taking snapshots of the web so that you could go back and you could see these documents and you could lay them side by side. All of them, the date is the same on all these, but the content is different. If you hadn't been able to do that, then there would be no way that you would have known. There would be no way that anybody have known or anybody coming to the document would have known that that's not the way that it was on March 27th of 2003, and that perhaps more than once it had been changed, but the date had not been changed.
The Internet Archive provides the authoritative way to find out how a document has been revised. But in the course of trying to figure out what had happened with these lists, we also look pretty broadly at blog sites and different web pages. And in real time, bloggers in the United States and around the world had saved out copies of this list and posted it online. And so there are many different – there are more versions of this list out there on blog sites than we've been able to recover even in our analysis here. But the question that arises is, how can you trust these things that have been pasted in many cases into a blog as being authoritative? Presumably the White House website has the real version, and that is why our findings are so problematic because – they aren't in many cases.
Well, and that's one of the caveats one always should keep in mind. You read stuff on the web, you read stuff on a blog, you read stuff on Wikipedia, you read stuff anywhere, even if it appears to be, say, a copy of a document that would come from an authoritative source like the White House, then I suppose one always should ask the question, is that what it purports to be, and is it what it says that it is?
Well, and that's one of the most troubling aspects is if you find multiple copies of a document out there and different people's blogs have it and they conflict with each other, you know, especially if it's a government piece of information, what are you going to do? You're going to go back to the original source. You know, this is a White House press release. You're going to go to the White House webpage. And if the White House website, you know, if it's got, you know, a date of the time, it's got this list and these other blogs have different versions, you know, which one are you going to trust? I mean, you know, from an early age, you're sort of taught, well, you know, this is an official government document. Here's the source. This is it. And you wouldn't even think to look broadly on Google. You know, with a document like this, let's say you're writing some paper and, you know, you need a list of the coalition. You're going to go to the White House webpage. You're going to pull it up, say, okay, there's my list, and move on. You're not even going to think for a moment to go out there and say, okay, well, are there any – has this document been revised? Is this really the original document?
Let me very quickly just introduce again our guest. Caleb Lutaro is coordinator of information technology and research at the Klein Center for Democracy here on the campus of the University of Illinois. And Scott Althaus is associate professor in the Departments of Political Science and Communication. And we're talking about something that they have been a subject of their research, and that is the way that the White House apparently has altered records on the official White House website over time. About this particular detail, this particular aspect of the Iraq War, without indicating that those have been altered, and why that's important and why that matters. And certainly we'll be talking some more about that as we move through the hour. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Just let me – well, I don't know, Scott, you want to –
Well, one thing that we would like to emphasize is that it's common for web pages to be updated over time. And usually an informational web page will be updated and perhaps a little tag will be on the bottom, last update at such and such a date or something like that. But the documents that we're talking about are not informational web pages. They are part of the public record. They were official press releases that were distributed by the White House and from all appearances appear to be historically authentic documents. And in many cases, they're not.
So essentially what you're saying is that you got no problem with the information changing or with the White House saying the information is changing. But what you're saying is if on the 20th, it's 45, you should – you're saying, okay, on the 20th it was 45. Maybe a week later it really was 48. But what what you would want them to do is the original press release that said it was 45 on the 20th should sit there saying it was 45 on the 20th. And then a week later, if you pick up another four countries, you say, hooray, we've picked up another four countries. This is what it is today on the 27th. And then if the next week it changes, then those two things should stay there. And if the next week it changes again, you should say, okay, you put out another press release, put today's date on it. You tell us what it is today. But don't go back and change the one from last week without saying that it was changed. And don't go back and take the one that was on there to start and just conveniently lose that because you'd just as soon not have that number around. That seems to be the issue.
I mean, think about newspapers. I mean, you know, newspapers routinely, you know, they miss a quote, they miss a number. They don't go back then on their websites and change that article. They put a corrections note. They keep the original article there and they say, correction, on this date, you know, this information was changed. So you can imagine something similar where on an informational web page, you might update that and change the date or something. But a press release is sort of a unique document. A press release, by its very nature, is a dated document saying on this date, this information is being released. And, you know, that information may change over time, but then you release a new release at that point. They're very different from sort of your traditional, you know, homepage of some site.
Mm-hmm. Well, and then I suppose a fundamental question here is this just sloppiness? Or is this, as I think you quite clearly in what you've written about this suggest, this is rewriting history?
Well, it's clear from our analysis, and our analysis is limited to the documentary evidence that we can find on the web at this time. We didn't interview anybody from the White House. We didn't have the opportunity to. What we found in these documents makes it clear that there have been a series of changes, any one of which might have been explained in isolation as just something that happened that was not connected to anything else. But what we find is a pattern. The pattern is consistent across these documents, and that leads us to conclude that it was an intentional pattern. But we don't know beyond that whether by intention this is evidence of a whitewashing campaign of some sort, or if it was simply sloppy webmastering techniques that treated these press releases as though they were just placeholders for updating information. There are some questions with some of these documents about which way it goes, but I think the larger pattern raises important questions about the amount of effort that went into changing these documents and shading the factual information that remains on the White House website. If we see it in documents like this, and is it 45 or 49, that to us may not seem like a big issue. For scholars, it is, to be able to pin down what was factually true at a given time. But it suggests that if this is part of a larger pattern or a larger tendency that went on in the White House web pages for a period of time, what else has been changed?
Yeah. And it's important too. I mean, the press at the time, when one of the coalition lists was removed in 2004, the press at the time noted that the coalition list was removed from the White House website, and the White House response at the time was, "We're simply doing some updates. We'll have a list back up shortly." But then the media never really followed up after that. And so what we've done here really is you know, the media in the past has reported, you know, some little changes, but what we've done here, the degree to which we've been able to chronicle the changes on this is, you know, you've got this whole history starting within days of the invasion and going to at least 2 years out of, you know, deletions, additions, removals, all these different types of changes. And that paints a very different picture, much more troubling picture than, you know, something that could be explained by just a one-off, oh, we accidentally deleted a page when we were cleaning up.
Okay. Well, we have several callers here. Let's bring some folks who are listening into the conversation, and we will start with someone in Champaign. And line one, hello.
Hi. You listen long enough, and you answer the question, and that was my response. Is this just the tip of the iceberg, you know, in terms of this White House? I think there's also, wasn't there, in terms of the emails, I mean, this is another issue, but that they were lost, they couldn't find them, the whole bit, and this is another issue. So anyway, great program.
All right, thanks. And you respond to that any way that you'd like or you can.
Yes, a number of bloggers have noted over the last several years, and some of this has been picked up by mainstream media, where individual files or documents have been taken down or changed. For instance, back in December of 2003, the Washington Post noted that the famous mission accomplished speech given by President Bush on the decks of the aircraft carrier Abraham Lincoln had been originally posted on the White House transcript page with the title Combat Operations Have Ended. It was much later after the fact that somebody went and changed that heading to Major Combat Operations Had Ended. This was picked up, but it was seen as an isolated thing. And what we've observed is that there are many, many instances where people have identified content that is no longer accessible or it seems to have been changed. But up to this point, there hadn't been a larger pattern that could be assembled, in part because there had been fairly limited use made of this resource, the Internet Archive, that we were able to use to track back to the original documents.
Yeah. And one of the things that I think that you're suggesting to people is that other people can do what you guys did, and that if there's some particular thing that they're interested in or they're following or that's there in their area of study or whatever, that they can do what you did to find out whether similar kinds of changes were made in other kinds of documents dealing with other kinds of subjects.
Yeah, I mean, the archive, the Internet Archive, which is just www.archive.org, it's a wonderful resource. It was begun in 1996 basically by a group that noted the fact that, you know, we're losing all this, you know, the web is constantly evolving, sites are going down, sites are changing, and no one's capturing any of this. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it doesn't capture every page all the time. You know, just like any other search engine, it's out there, it's crawling, it gets some pages, it doesn't get others. Sometimes it'll capture one web page, you know, every single day for 2 weeks and then not see it again for a year. So you have holes in the coverage, but you can basically go to this, type in any URL. So take the University of Illinois homepage, paste that in there, and you can see from 1996 to present all these snapshots that are available of it. And, you know, even on a page where you're not thinking that there's potential changes there, it's fascinating to see how different what did the U of I homepage look like 10 years ago. But, you know, if there is something of importance, you know, here's a legal document, and you think, wow, this seems strange. This can't have been this way originally. You can type that into Internet Archive and see, well, does the Internet Archive have an older snapshot, and then if so, pull that up and say, wow, do I see any changes here?
Yeah, okay. Did the U of I have a homepage 10 years ago?
They were very early on. They actually, U of I was very, I mean, Mosaic, sort of the modern web browser invented here, so obviously they've had a, yeah, for, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Okay, pardon me for impugning the technological advancement of the U of I. Let's go to Champaign line number two. Hello.
Has anybody looked at written documents, and have these changed, or are you limiting your search to just the internet?
Yeah, the information that we looked at was only available on the internet to us. Scholars in years to come will be able to have access to some of the written record of this White House. I've been doing archival research at presidential libraries around the country, and once you get up to around Ronald Reagan's era, the ability to access documents on paper is extremely thin. So often there's several decades before scholars or interested persons can get access to the paper records. And of course, we'd be very curious to see what the paper records for these documents were, but we don't have access to that.
Is it, as in the case of this President Bush, who said his father, President Bush's papers were going to be sealed, can the incoming president unseal all these papers?
I'm not sure about the details on that issue, but my understanding is the Presidential Records Act of 1974 mandates that there should be a 12-year gap between the time that the White House occupant leaves the White House before the unsealing of those records can begin. That's my understanding, and that gap may have been lengthened because of the more recent legislation that has been done.
Well, and also, too, your average citizen now, you know, with the Internet, we're turning more and more to the Internet for our information. And so you're no longer going to, you know, your local government depository library in most cases to take a look at a press release from the White House. You're much more likely to, you know, and in many cases, you know, a lot of these documents are no longer as routinely distributed to these libraries. You're going to go on the Internet. You're going to go on the White House homepage. And so, you know, even scholars aside, you know, very dedicated scholars, the fact that these pages are changed, you're really impacting what the general population's understanding of this is.
And there's a question about how many of these documents actually exist on paper anymore. Mm-hmm. We've also looked at other archives that purport to hold whatever the White House press office issues in terms of press releases. And the Nexus archive is what we use for that. And we found that only the releases of the list from March 20th and 21st, the day before and the day of the Iraq invasion on the ground, were maintained in the Nexus archives. That means all the other documents that we've been able to find appear not to have been distributed through normal channels, and it's not clear whether there is a paper version of these documents at all. They seem to have been posted directly to the White House webpage, and that also raises concerns about limiting the other copies that might be available and kept in other places by which you could check to see if the originals have been changed in some way.
Well, thank you for your research.
You're welcome.
I never would have considered it. I'm not a supporter of this administration by any means. And it's just another example of the people who moved into the White House and pulled down the shades and decided they were in charge and nobody else mattered.
Well, again, we don't know who did this or why. And in our report, we're very clear about that, and we're not pointing fingers. But I think the consequences for the American public and our understanding of the historical record over these last 8 years are profound. If we don't have access to what the documents look like on a given date, it becomes very difficult to know what was the actual history that transpired. And that's our concern. We both, Kalev and I, use archival data in our research. And we go into those archives trusting that while only part of the story may have been put down on paper, and while people may have motives to say things in particular ways, that the documents that exist that purport to present basic facts about what the government did and did not do at a given time should be valid. And that's what causes us to be so concerned about the findings that we made here. And I want to emphasize that we did not intend to find this at all. This was the result of a copy editor coming back and pointing out an error. This is not anything that we were looking for. But once we found it, we felt that we needed to get the word out to scholars and other people who might be interested in using these documents so they would be aware of this problem. And for the larger public who might be concerned about this, to be able to follow the procedure that we use, which is very simple, to go and see if there are other documents that might have been altered in this way.
Yeah. I think, an interesting aspect of the story, as you explained earlier, that you had written this paper, and it mentioned a particular URL, and the person was just checking all the things in the paper, and they came back to you and said, hey, wait a minute, I'm going to this URL, and it's a blank page.
Yep.
And you said, oh, that's interesting. Okay, maybe I got that wrong. And you went to it and it got a blank page. And you started thinking, well, that's strange. And that one thing led to another led to another. And without that, if that had not happened, you hadn't written this paper, it hadn't been checked, you hadn't found the blank page, you guys never would have done it. We wouldn't be having this conversation.
No, and this discovery happened quite recently. This was the Thursday after the election in November. So we worked on this analysis for about 2 weeks or so, and then we're ready to show it to a broader audience. But it was nothing that we had intended to find.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Scott Althaus. He's associate professor in the departments of political science and communication here at U of I, Urbana-Champaign, and Kalev Lutaro. He's coordinator of information technology and research at the Klein Center for Democracy here at U of I. He's also chief tech advisor to the Institute for Computing in the Humanities, Arts, and Social Science, and a center affiliate of the National Center for Supercomputing Applications. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Next up, we have someone here in Champaign County where we are, line 3. Hello.
Hi. Both of the previous callers made points that I don't think were sufficiently addressed. The first caller mentioned the emails, and these aren't the same kind of public documents that you were talking about, but these are ones that would be subject to that Presidential Records Act. But both the RNC servers and the actual White House servers have these huge gaps in their records of the email, and they just say, well, whoops, or something. And they're very suspicious times. I think someone did a study of that. So that's just, underpins the whole lying malfeasance of this particular government. But the other point was that about the fulfillment of the presidential records. Again, this is about the so-called internal documents. When Bush 2 came in, one of the first things he did was somehow finesse that act and keep his father's records buried for much longer, if I recall. So that's, again, but on the subject of the public record, doesn't the archive at the Library of Congress routinely document these things, too? It seems like the fact that you have to go to a volunteer Internet archive is just amazing to me, and that it seems to me that the archive at the LLC would be tracking these documents, too, and at least keeping a contemporary record of them. So I don't know. I guess because they rely on some kind of veracity on the, they don't do the periodic snapshot.
That's right. So my understanding.
Well, I'll hang up and listen.
Okay. Sure. Right. My understanding of the Presidential Records Act of 1974 is that the act designates the executive branch as the temporary archivist of its own materials. And so it is to maintain those materials in order to pass them on when the administration has completed its course to the National Archives and Records Administration. So there, my understanding at least, there is no official archiving that occurs outside of the executive branch that would allow us to be able to look and see these things in another place. Now, there are parts of what the president says, particularly any public statements made by the president, that are transcribed and reported over to the government printing office. So there are certain forms of presidential communication that are archived in multiple places by the government. But the press releases are one of those categories of information for which we have had a very difficult time finding other copies in other archives outside of NexisLexis.
Hmm. Well, let me ask you this question about the Presidential Records Act. If the White House issues a press release and then later deletes it, or if they issue a press release and then later make changes without changing the date on the release, is that a violation of the Presidential Records Act?
It may be. And what the maybe hinges on is whether there is an original copy that has been maintained somewhere else, so that what has been deleted is just a copy of another document that's maintained elsewhere. We are not legal scholars. We have no basis for offering a judgment of whether what we found is a violation of the Presidential Records Act. But the Presidential Records Act does explicitly include electronic records as part of the information that must be maintained. And I think if it's not illegal what we found, it certainly raises the question of what it means for the American people when its government would have to maintain two sets of documents, one for the archivists that represent the way things actually transpired, and one for the broader public that represent the aspects of those things that the administration feels comfortable allowing the American public to see.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Indiana, Kingwood, Indiana, line 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
What a fascinating conversation. You guys have stumbled on a concept called document control, which is something that industry knows all too well and has known about for a long, long time. I work with primarily the automotive industry, but many other industries also. And controlling documents is a critical issue because you have to make sure that the latest and greatest, most current revision is available at point of use to the people who need it, especially if you're doing something important like, oh, designing a brake system for an automobile. But, you know, government is even more important than that. What industry knows and what industry conforms to are requirements in international standards organization documents like ISO 9000 and ISO 14000 that require documents to be identified with their current revision level and obsolete documents to be pulled down, marked as obsolete, and removed from points of use. And I think the downfall with the government is that they don't have that kind of requirement that they need to adhere to, or maybe they do and I've missed that in your conversation. But, you know, you've stumbled on a huge, huge problem of controlling information in this information age. You talk about documents which are living and breathing and change over time because they're used to give out information. But once that information is published, then that becomes a record. And a record is not changeable.
Yeah, I mean, you're touching on a couple of issues. Certainly versioning is, I mean, what you're really describing definitely is versioning, in that, you know, in a corporate environment or, you know, really any type of environment, if you have a living document and it's an important document, you keep snapshots of that. As every time you make a change, you keep those previous versions there, so you can always reflect back and say, what did this document look like at this point in time? You know, on the web, we really don't have this type of versioning control, and so
except for date and timestamps and URL marks.
Yeah, and of course, one of the issues with date and timestamps on web pages is that, you know, they really, a date and timestamp at the bottom saying last modified, that's meaningless, because really that's a piece of text that, you know, that could be generated by the web server as an actual reflection of when the page was edited, or it could be a human that has to edit that every time they make a change to the page. And so, you know, in this case, the Internet Archive is sort of acting as a proxy, and you're absolutely right that, you know, this is an issue where, you know, on the web, we don't have this type of versioning control. Actually, the Internal Revenue Service in their most recent handbook to examiners actually referenced your point about corporations with this issue on their external websites, in that it advises examiners to say, you know, let's say you're investigating some particular issue. What did this company's website say about this? You know, let's say this is about a particular product. They actually advise their examiners to use the Internet Archive to go back through time and see what did the company's website have about this material at this particular point in time. Again, you know, this sort of versioning control. But there's also the issue of press releases, in that there's a big difference between something like a user manual, where a user manual or a technical guide or something that a company is using, that's designed to reflect what's the current status of this. You know, I mean, think about your toaster oven or something. Every time it goes to revision, you know, the user manual shouldn't say how to operate the toaster, you know, from 10 years ago. It should reflect a current one. A press release is something very different. A press release is intended to be a snapshot in time. It's intended to say, you know, a company releases a product. That press release stands in time. 20 years after that product has been discontinued, that press release has become a historical record. New press releases will be issued for new products. And that's part of the issue here, is that These documents are very, you know, press releases should be immutable. They should never really be changed after the fact.
Absolutely. Who said history is written by the victors? Greatest strength of the United States of America is the fourth institution, the press. So you go, guys. Thank you.
Well, thank you for the call. We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guests are Caleb Lutaro. He's the last guy that you heard. He's a coordinator of information technology and research at the Klein Center for Democracy here on the U of I campus. Scott Althaus is associate professor in the Departments of Political Science and Communication. If, by the way, you're interested in reading in some detail this work that they did, you can look at go to the website of the Klein Center and look at their paper, Airbrushing History American Style, and you can read there all about it in greater depth than we can go into here at this program. But certainly additional questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. I guess, again, I find myself coming back to the you know, the central question being that someone might look at what you did and look at the changes that appear to have been made in these documents on the White House website and might say something like, well, you know, yes, we can understand that maybe what the White House is trying to do is make it look like right from the start there was as many countries as they could possibly add to their list, you know. But truly they might say, well, you know, if it's 45, it's 48, it's 49, does that really matter very much? That's really not, as far as you're concerned, that's sort of a small point. The larger point, though, is can you rely on the information that you find on an official place like the White House website where it says this is what it is and this is what it was on this time? And I suppose that's the issue is here is do you trust this information?
That's right. And, you know, we live in a culture where there's spin coming from all different corners. But spin as a way of casting a favorable interpretation on a set of facts is very different from deception, hiding some facts and drawing attention to others. And that's different from falsification, actually changing facts and presenting them as the original. For us as scholars, it's falsification that is the most profound problem that we face, because where else are we going to turn to uncover the historical record than to official government documents that purport to show what the facts were at a given point in time?
Mm-hmm. I mean, one of these examples is Costa Rica was one of the countries that was removed later on, and that was due to Costa Rica's Supreme Court saying this is a violation of our constitution to remain on this list. And they had requested previously to be removed and be removed, and they hadn't been removed. Now, if you go to that list and you find this coalition list that does not mention Costa Rica, if, you know, let's say you're going back through old newspaper reports, you're seeing all this controversy. If Costa Rica keeps demanding to be removed from the list, you go to the, you know, back to the list that's on the White House website and you say, well, they were never on the list from the very beginning. Then that begins to have this real impact of confusion. Well, you know, how is this so?
And in the end, the Iraq invasion was not justified on the basis of this list. Were there 45 or 49? This was a document that was used to help show or demonstrate that there was a broad level of support for what the president did. But the larger question for us isn't 45 or 49. It's can we trust these documents? For many scholars, 45 or 49 does matter. In the case of the paper that I was checking up on, I needed to know which countries were in the coalition in order to make other assessments about whether certain countries had received favorable status in the embedded journalism system. So often we can't anticipate what importance a small set of factual changes might have until we realize that it becomes very difficult to track down to the beginning of what the actual facts were. And for Kalev and I, it took us about 3 weeks to get to the bottom of what countries and how many were at the start of the Iraq invasion listed on the government's official coalition list.
Yeah. You can also think, too, if you think about the amount of work that was put into changing these lists. I mean, look at how much effort was put into the deletions, the modifications through time. And you say, you know, this tiny little list, all the effort that was put into this, you know, what might have been done with larger, more visible portions of the White House website? And certainly there have been, as we said before, there's been sort of these assorted media reports through time of a change here, a change over here, a change here. But to see all this put together and say, you know, here's one particular topic, the coalition list, and then to see, you know, over 2 years, the number of revisions that were done, the way those revisions were done, it sort of paints this very concerning picture of what might be done elsewhere on the White House website as well.
And it's important to underscore that the information we're looking at had been released to the public in real time. So it wasn't as though there was a security issue or a secrecy issue. The government had already decided that it could be released. And what we found was then after the fact, changes were made. And if those kinds of changes were made on a list in time, in real time, when media organizations knew what countries were on and how many there were, then what else might have happened where there was not as much vigilance as to the facts at the time?
The study that you did has gotten some attention in the national media. Has anyone then gone to the White House and said, you know, what about this? Asked them if they had some sort of comment about this?
The New York Times did a story on our findings, and the reporter for that story, Tom Shanker, talked to the White House, and their response was to note that two countries had been deleted, due to diplomatic sensitivities with those countries. But to our knowledge, the White House has never explained the deletions of the documents that we found. We can certainly pin down that there was not some sort of widespread deletion of documents during this period of time. These were targeted documents that were brought down. And we've also heard no explanation yet from the White House as to why countries were added after the fact. We don't know.
And I'm just curious now, again, maybe now what more people will do is do what you have done and to go to not only look at other things on the White House website, but perhaps look at the websites that are maintained by cabinet departments or federal agencies, where there are similarly all kinds of press releases and information dealing with all sorts of subjects, to find out whether that kind of thing has happened elsewhere. As far as you know, is anybody else doing the kind of thing that you did, looking at other aspects of White House activity, or for that matter, other areas of government?
Not to our knowledge yet, not systematically. But that's one of the reasons why we wrote this report and tried to get the word out about it, because it's unclear to us what's going to happen to the current White House website when the transition occurs in mid-January to the Obama administration. Back when the Clinton administration transferred to the Bush administration, the electronic files, or at least some snapshots of the White House webpage, were transferred over to NARA, the National Administration of Records. And versions of that Clinton White House website are still available, five versions, but it's not a complete snapshot. And it's not clear to us whether that was just a voluntary act on the part of the Clinton administration or not. Our understanding of the Presidential Records Act is that the occupants of the White House have the discretion to seal up all of their records for 12 years. And so it's possible that the White House website, as we can find it today, may not be accessible to the broader public after the transition, or may not be accessible in the form that's in right now. So we want to get word out to people who might be curious and concerned to follow up on documents that may be of interest to them, to take those URLs from the White House webpage, take them over to archive.org, put them in the Wayback Machine, and see if they find changes or deletions or modifications.
Yeah, I love that, the Wayback Machine.
Yes, from a cartoon that I grew up with.
How many kids today know about the Wayback Machine? Well, I think this is really interesting an important point that indeed it's not that, you know, after this administration is gone, not necessarily that all that material is going to go away forever, but they could, for a period of time, make that go away for that specified period of time. And so that for anyone, whatever their interest was, scholarly or otherwise, that material would be locked up for 12 years and no one would be able to look at it. The idea would be that then, yeah, in 12 years it would become available and nothing is supposed to be destroyed or deleted, but it wouldn't be accessible.
That's right. And that's just a question that we don't know the answer to right now. We aren't aware of what plans are being made for the future status of the White House webpage that exists today.
Yeah. I'm just curious. We have a couple of minutes left. We haven't really talked at all about the project that you were working on that got you into this in the first place, about embedding reporters with troops, and whether or not at the time people said, well, this is just so that the government and the military can have more control over what stories get out. It seemed to be that you found out that, as far as the military was concerned, that was actually not there.
And that's the irony of these findings that Kalev and I stumbled on, is that the original article that started this, by looking at the archival evidence, the documentary evidence of how the embedded journalism system came to be for the Iraq invasion in 2003, we found that while originally and for the Afghanistan invasion of 2001, the Department of Defense would have preferred to maintain exclusive control and limit access of journalists to the war sites, what they found in Afghanistan was that's a losing proposition. The government can no longer control the transmission of information out of these war zones because of satellite technology and the ability of people to infiltrate on the ground and report out. And the military was not positioned to be a rapid or credible witness when allegations came up that a bomb hit a civilian house and children were killed. It's hard for the Department of Defense to say, no, wait, we'll get back to you, and in 2 weeks later come up with a conclusion that it was an accident or it didn't happen. In those intervening 2 weeks, what the government found was that satellite television in the Arab world had 2 weeks to report on this exclusively, and it was very difficult for the Department of Defense to try to get its own side of the story out. And so for the Iraq invasion, having realized that that was a failed way of doing things, the Department of Defense was lobbied pretty heavily by bureau chiefs from national news organizations to use the embedded journalism system, which had been used on a trial basis in Bosnia and Kosovo earlier on, and to bring that up as the standard means of reporting. So in contrast to what a lot of people think, which is the Department of Defense imposed this system on journalists to restrict their access, the broader story is that journalists requested this system themselves in order to gain broader access, and the Department of Defense was quite willing to say, our motives for allowing you this access are perfectly selfish because we want trained neutral observers on the front lines with our forces to be able to show when an allegation is untrue that's been made about atrocities committed apparently by U.S. forces. That's why they did it.
Yeah. Well, we're down, coming down to the point here where we pretty much have to finish because we've used our time. And I do want to mention again, for people who are interested in reading in some depth, that the paper that you guys have written about this, the business of the changing of the materialists on the White House website, if they go to the website of the Klein Center for Democracy, here it's based here at the U of I, they can read your paper, Airbrushing History, American Style. Any last sort of thought that you'd like to leave with folks?
No, I mean, I think if you have questions about what you see on the web, you know, use these resources. Use things like the Internet Archive. Use these others, to see what's out there.
It's easy to do. It does not require a PhD to go and use the Internet Archive. Anybody could do it. Anybody could have written the report that we did.
Right. Our guest, Scott Althaus. He's an associate professor in the Departments of Political Science and Communication here at the U of I. And Kalev Lutaro, he's coordinator of information technology and research at the Klein Center for Democracy here based on the campus. Thank you both very much for being here.
You're very welcome.
Appreciate it. Thank you.